Good Monday morning. Hope you're having a good day so far today. Hi there and welcome to the second hour of our show this morning. I'm Raquel with you until 12:30 this afternoon. And here's what's ahead on the show for you today. It is time this hour for another edition of Science Files. And St. Mary's University astrophysicist Rob Thacker is with us again this morning. And I'll make the introduction in just a moment. After the news at 11, it's your turn to sound off today. We'll go to the phones for our first open hour of the week. We call it Manic Monday. And, of course, as always, anything goes. Then after the news at noon, Toronto lawyer Jack Lloyd will tell us about his latest case. The country's cannabis lawyers representing a Halifax woman who is challenging police roadside saliva testing laws after she tested positive for THC 7 hours after she last consumed pot. And we'll hear more about the role two Nova Scotia battalions played at the Battle of Vimy Ridge in World War I. April 9th, tomorrow, is Vimy Ridge Day. Military historian John Below will join me this afternoon with more. But right now, it's time for another edition of Science Files, and joining me this morning is St. Mary's University astrophysicist Dr. Rob Thacker. Dr. Rob, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you all set for, again, what we thought was the last of winter?
Everyone can blame my wife.
Yes. Your wife's at fault here.
Yeah, so we have this little tent that we put over one of the bushes in our front lawn, which doesn't get along too well with the really cold weather. And my wife, Linda, said on Saturday, you know, I'm going to bring that in. We're not going to get any more snow. And I'm like, well, you know, we might. And she brought it in and boom.
Yes. In fact, snow tonight into tomorrow, snow flurries Tuesday and again Wednesday.
Yeah, so we're saying, what, about 15 centimeters total?
15 to 20 potentially.
15 to 20. Okay.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But anyway.
That's 6 to 8 inches.
I know. Yikes. Yeah. But by Wednesday, Thursday, temperatures will be up around 10 degrees. So it's all going to go away very quickly.
It's going to be a slush fair very quickly.
Yep. And hopefully that will be the last.
Fingers crossed. Although, as people like to tell me, there have been snowstorms here in May. So.
There have been. Yeah. And I do recall some of those. So. Yeah. In fact, I tell you a quick story. I remember it snowing in the 1st of June. This was, I was about to begin my motorcycle trip across Canada on the 1st of June, 1974, and as I headed down the road, it began to snow. So.
better get my snow tires on.
Yeah, yes, it did. All right, but this is Science Files, and if you've got a question for Dr. Rob this morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255, and Canadian astronaut David St. Jacques is poised to take his first spacewalk trip, and he's going to do it this morning, Dr. Rob.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. So that's going to be one heck of an experience. I mean, being up at that altitude, looking down on the Earth,
that would be,
just in a spacesuit, that's going to be trippy.
It would be trippy, but it'd be fascinating, would it not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there aren't many rides that you can get that have a better view than that,
that's seriously for sure.
And I mean, so I do kind of think that the thing, as cool as doing a spacewalk is, I have to say that the sort of like little jetpack that the U.S. astronauts used to be able to use that must be something else.
But these guys would be attached. He'd be attached to the...
I believe so. I haven't actually looked too much into what the specific requirements of this particular spacewalk are. Actually, I've been looking more at that whole issue of the two women who were supposed to be going out to do a joint spacewalk. Yeah. And thank you for not planning. They didn't have the right size spacesuit,
so they
could do that. So that's incredibly frustrating. And you know, I'm going to get on my hobby horse, symptomatic of the fact that with a lot of testing that we do, whether it's building a spacesuit or whether it's testing cars or whatever, we tend to have male models or think of male proportions. And of course, half the population isn't male. So this is something that we are starting to address, but it's been far too late, and it's a really serious issue, to be quite frank. So,
well, again, there were two women supposed to be on the spacewalk.
But that's right.
Only one spacesuit fit.
And so one of them was used to working in a larger size spacesuit. But again, I mean, you shouldn't. They do, I think it's three different sizes of spacesuits, and, you know, there should be a small one that people can use as well. So anyway, it's something that NASA has said, we kind of messed up on that and we're going to fix it. So that they are sort of moving towards being more aware of these issues, as you would hope. And obviously there are a number of female scientists involved in NASA. But, you know, to be quite frank, I mean, it shouldn't be these things get thought about because you have a female on the team anyway. It should be something everyone thinks about.
And more females, again, are taking part in what has been traditionally male jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, the whole thing with crash test dummies for a very long time was something that was... in a sense, obvious, but here you had male engineers 20 years ago just putting male models into these, well, models,
male dummies.
Dummies, that's right. Yes, crash test dummies, exactly. Thank you. I'm the dummy. So so anyway, fortunately, again, that has been recognized, but nonetheless, it's annoying that it took people to really think about this, to actually do something about it.
Well, Saint-Jacques and U.S. astronaut Anne McClain are, in fact, on the spacewalk right now.
Yeah.
They are working on an alternative power source for the Canada-made robotic arm, the Canada Arm 2. And they're removing a defective piece on the mechanical arm so it can later install a nickel hydrogen battery.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, they'll be out there for... these spacewalks aren't just a couple of minutes. They're typically hours.
Oh, they're hours.
Yeah.
Yes, 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 yes. So, I mean, I'm just wondering about that, because if they have batteries on the Canada arm, that must be because it's not providing, or it has backup power in case it loses connection to the main body or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's a backup backup plan, but... don't know for that to be a fact, but it'd be, how neat would it be to be out there walking in space right now?
The whole thing with these things taking several hours, I mean, obviously you're going to the bathroom, so you've got all of those things in the spacesuit if you need them. Yeah.
Yeah, never thought of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So there would be a little container or something?
Yep.
Okay.
Well, really kind of giant nappies, but anyway. It really is less glamorous than it sounds. It doesn't sound very glamorous.
Yeah. The Canadian record for the most spacewalks is held by retired astronaut Dave Williams, who ventured outside the space station three times during a 2007 mission for a total of nearly 18 hours outside the space
station. So that actually gives you your average spacewalk is about 6 hours.
Yeah, really? Yeah, very fascinating. Yeah. And how neat would that be to be out there just floating around? In space.
You know, that's to have been he was the first person to do it. It was a Russian, wasn't it? I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
To actually be out there in space, just this spacesuit protecting you from the great beyond and all of the radiation and so on, that's a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, you've asked me if I'd like to go up, and I've kind of said, you know, I'm not sure.
But you would.
I would. Yes. Yeah, I kind of would.
So would I. I mean, I'd probably get violently ill. I'm not good. I'm prone to seasickness and all of that. But for the experience.
Well, so actually, there's a really interesting story there. Have you done that? So there was a Senator Jake Garm, who was a military person. And as he was involved more and more in the higher levels of the government, was very much involved in looking at budgets and making sure that things were being done right. And somehow or another, he got a ride on the space shuttle.
Oh, really?
But he was older, and so he was unbelievably space sick, right? He literally couldn't do anything. He was so space sick, throwing up. And obviously, if you throw up, as we've discussed, it's dangerous and so on. So basically, he was confined to quarters for the whole trip. And so now, it's completely serious, the astronauts measure your level of space sickness with the Garn scale.
Oh.
And so he has gone down in NASA folklore for this. I mean, obviously, I feel very sad for him having gone up into space and not been able to really get much out of it. But anyway, yes, the Garn scale measures space sickness.
Yeah. So how does it do that?
Oh, you just have certain levels of certain symptoms, and the worst you can get is what he had, level 7 or whatever it is the full Jake Garn scale.
So. Yeah. 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Just got a few questions coming in on via email here. My email address, rick.howe@news957.com. You can even tweet us a question. Our Twitter handle, @TheRickHowe Show. It is 10:15. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with more on Science Files with Dr. Rob right after this. 10:18, a Monday morning, Science Files here till 11 o'clock. Dr. Rob is my guest. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And our numbers, if you've got a question, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Mark sends a question via email, and he wonders, does the space station need to be periodically adjusted to stay in a proper orbit and not fall back toward Earth? I would assume the answer would have to be yes to that.
It actually does, yeah. It's so one of the things that we tend to think about is the atmosphere kind of goes up and then stops at some point. But it doesn't really do that. It kind of just keeps on going, getting thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. So the ISS isn't high enough that it's really in an orbit that won't decay. So something like geostationary satellites, which are at 36,000 kilometers away, those things just don't decay on any sort of like reasonable timescale. They'll just keep going and going and going. Whereas the International Space Station does. So for a long time, they would boost it with the shuttle. And now I believe they boost it primarily with the Soyuz, although the ISS does have its own thrusters if it had to boost itself, so it could. So the short answer is yes, absolutely it does need to be boosted. I think it's like once a year or once every few months.
So could
it's not that often.
Could it stay up there forever or eventually?
It would come down on the time scale of years you're talking about, the same way that Skylab came down on the scales of years. Yeah. So it's not entirely dissimilar. I'm sure it's a somewhat different orbit. But anyway, that's the main thing. It would come down eventually,
I forgot about Skylab. That was the very first space station. Yeah,
that's right.
This is from Colin. Rather convoluted question here, but let me read this. He says he was watching Family Guy the other day, and there's an episode in which Stewie, the evil genius baby, and Brian, the talking dog, use Stewie's time machine and end up blown outside the space-time continuum into non-existence. No laws of physics, no reality. Upon overloading the time machine return pad, they blast back into existence, at which point Stewie points out his return pad blast background radiation matches that of the Big Bang, and he concludes that his return pad blast was the Big Bang and that he created the universe. He explains to Brian that the universe created him so that he could create the universe, that it was a temporal casualty loop. It was all very scientific sounding. But then I noticed, he writes, during the credits, it listed Neil deGrasse Tyson as a consultant for the episode, and he's a bona fide genius. So I'd have to imagine that there's some kind of actual science or theory to temporal casualty loops.
So there is something called closed time-like curves, which is an idea that comes out of general relativity. So I'm just like, whenever you say, Stewie. Yes, Brian. So coming back to that, so I'm going to get myself so off topic with this, with closed time-like curves. So that is the concept of something in general relativity where you can establish kind of a loop to the future and back again. And once that's in place, you, in theory, can come back and keep using that loop repeatedly. There was what was the movie? There was some independent movie. It was, name escapes me right now, but it wasn't Looper. It was something else. But they basically had this theory in there.
Bruce Willis, was he in that?
Bruce Willis was in Looper, but it wasn't the Looper movie. It was another one. I can't remember the name of it for the life of me. Sorry, I'm blanking out. But anyway, so they had this closed time-like curve. And so that allowed them to go from the future back into the past. But it had been established at one point. So it was kind of like a hole into the future in a certain kind of way as well. And so in terms of Stewie and Brian going into the future and coming back again, I would love to see the episode, because the only other thing that I've seen on Family Guy in terms of them doing the theory of creating the universe was God doing the pull my finger joke.
they can get a little silly on that.
I honestly don't know.
But Tyson is, again, he is a bona fide genius, right?
Yeah. Well, I think Neil wouldn't go that far. I mean, Neil did a PhD. He published a number of papers, and he's gone off to do a fantastic work promoting science. So, even in Neil's own estimation, there are people who are better researchers out there than he is, but that aren't very many people who are better at telling people about science than he is.
So. Yeah. But it'd be interesting. It's neat that shows like that will go to people like him and ask
yeah.
Her.
Well, yeah. So there is a connection here that people may not be about. And so that's Seth MacFarlane. And Seth MacFarlane is a real science geek.
Oh, really?
Right?
Okay.
So he's been on the Orville, the sort of like sci-fi thing. Yeah, yeah. But as well as that, he was one of the co-producers of the Cosmos series.
Oh, really? With Carl Sagan?
No, the new one.
Oh, the new one. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry.
So... So he's really a bit of a science geek, right? And so you can see why he would go and ask, because, I mean, he has a connection with Neil. He's worked with Neil. Yep. So, yeah, that's why he's acting as a consultant on this.
All right. Speaking of television shows with a scientific
Lewis?
Twist.
Well, sorry, you've done. Stewie is one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, Stewie is a pretty good character.
I find it very funny.
And Brian the Talking Dog as well. Yeah, but yeah. Big Bang Theory is coming to a very end, of, not only a season ending, but a series ending. They are winding down the show. And this has gone. This is a show that's contributed.
It's over 10 seasons,
yeah,
right?
And it's contributed a large part to, again, an interest in science.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But you haven't. You're not a big fan.
I blow hot and cold on the Big Bang Theory because as much good as it's done, I think it's done a lot of damage in terms of, like, getting these stereotypes out there and making people think that all physicists are people who go around, like, Sheldon and like, not able to connect with other individuals. I mean, it's not to say there aren't people like that. There are, obviously. But there's plenty of people like that in other forms of life as well.
True.
So you don't just have to rain on physicists for this. But I do tend to agree that it does paint a realistic picture in terms of what people who are very focused on what they do tend to be like. And when you're kind of obsessed with something, I mean, that's one of the things that people have complained a little bit about the culture of physics, that... But the people who do it are really kind of obsessed with it. And that's one of the reasons why you become successful in many cases, because when you're totally, totally and utterly devoted to something, you just do it all the time and you love it and you remember stuff about it. So you get good at it and so on. And so that's been something that's been a bit of a challenge for the culture of physics to handle. And things are changing a bit. There are, of course, other people who are equally talented who don't want to spend 60 hours a week doing things like that. And we've coming to realize that, you know, there's room for all different types of people in this profession as well. Yeah. So that it's changing.
But in regards to the TV show itself, I mean, if not for Big Bang Theory, I don't think people like me, for example, would really know a whole lot about the string theory, for example.
What do you know about?
I don't know anything about it. I just know,
you know
that
it exists.
I know it exists, and I know that it's something that many scientists are still trying to unravel.
Give them credit for that. Absolutely. So they have brought a number of things into the modern vernacular to use a Stewieism. absolutely. They've done a good job with that. And I can't deny that when it first came on, my wife and I had a bit of a giggle at it, but it got fairly tired in the end, because there's only so much you can do with that kind of personality type, I think.
Yeah. Well, again, after, 10 seasons, it's coming to an end. I believe there are 4 or 5 episodes left, if that.
I mean, congrats to them for keeping it going this long. Yeah. I mean, I've watched some of the later seasons, and, you know, there's still some pretty good jokes in there.
So. Yep. And Sheldon and his wife are now Nobel Prize potential candidates, and I'm assuming that...
Yeah, you see, that's not true to real life, because you only win the Nobel Prize when you're nearly dead.
Exactly. That's the way it goes. So we'll have to...
Sorry,
that's very facetious. You'll have to wait another few years.
We're trying to fix that. But no, again, it's a situation where... we had Bertram Brockhaus, who was a nuclear physicist who received it very late in life. Yep. And it was like, you know, he could have received that earlier.
Hmm. And how do people get nominated, by the way? Does the committee look for people to nominate, or
that
do
is
people
a good question.
Send in nominations?
So I'm not entirely sure. I believe that the committee can actually request nominations, but you can still send something in. But I don't know for sure. I've always wondered this. And I know people who've written nominations as well. So... Yeah, I don't know is the honest answer.
Okay. It is coming up to 10:28. We're going to take a break here in a moment for a news update and then more with Dr. Rob Thacker. He's an astrophysicist at St. Mary's University. And if you've got a question or a comment for Dr. Rob this morning, give us a call at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. You can also send us a question via email. My email address, rick.howe@news957.com. Or tweet us a question, our Twitter handle at The Rick Howe Show. We'll take a quick break right now, though. We've got a news update coming up. Then more with Dr. Rob. We're back right after the news.
Devin.
Meet the Jetsons. 10:33. Welcome back to Science Files here with Dr. Rob Thacker till 11 o'clock. And if you've got a question for us.
You know, you shouldn't have mentioned Family Guy.
Why?
Because I'm going to be you. Would you like some cool whip? Cool whip?
Yeah.
He's shaking his head. He's like, no, stop it now.
It's time to welcome our new guest here, Norman. Norm is a screaming goat.
Oh, it's not a breakfast show. Come on, come on.
Let's go to the phones here quickly before we lose control. Wayne, good morning.
Good morning. My question concerns fusion. Okay. I understand several countries are working, have the researchers working very hard to develop a process where they could use fusion to generate power, like electricity. Now, under what I understand very little about fusion is you have to have a couple of molecules or atoms smashed together at high speed, and they generate a huge amount of heat when they do that. And if they do, how can we build them in a million degrees? How can we build a machine that could withstand that heat and at the same time capture that energy to generate electrical power?
Okay. Dr. Roth.
Excellent question.
Can I hang up and just listen?
Sure enough.
Sure.
Appreciate it, Wayne. Yep, thanks. Yep.
So that is an excellent question. And actually, believe it or not, speaks to some of the difficulties with creating a modern working fusion reactor. So let's sort of like backtrack a little bit and explain what fusion is, and then we'll go from there. So fusion is one of the unusual properties of very, very light nuclei, that when you actually put them together, you actually release energy. People may be aware that with fission, you get energy from when you break things apart. Well, that's the nature of the nuclear force in general. And it just so happens that for the very light atoms, you smush them together, you get energy. For the very heavy ones, you break them apart, you get energy. There's kind of a weird sort of like U-shaped curve. But anyway, so the idea is you smash things together. This is what's happening in the sun all the time. That's where the energy from the sun is coming from. Things are being merged together, energy is being released, and so on. And so we want to do this in a controlled way. You're literally doing exactly the same kind of thing that we do in a fission reactor, which is to do something that in an uncontrolled way is a nuclear weapon. But we want to do it in a controlled way inside a fusion reactor, as we will call it. And now the good thing I will say is that the radiation from fusion is nothing like the radiation that comes out of fission products. Those are very heavy atoms, long-lived radioisotopes in many cases. Fusion should, in theory, be actually quite friendly and better to work with, although you can use certain radioactive isotopes to do it. But anyway, in general, fusion power is meant to be thought to be clean and sort of essentially endless supply of this energy, because you just need hydrogen. So the challenge is you've got to do this at about 100 million kelvins. You've got to have a hot plasma looping around inside the reactor. And Wayne has said, well, isn't that temperature just going to melt everything around it? Well, not quite, because it's actually inside a vacuum. Right. And so you have basically a vacuum where you have the plasma inside that. And so the conduction that would normally happen in the air and things like that is not going to happen inside. So in fact, actually, the reactor walls are protected from this. Every now and again, things will bump into them. That is a problem. Every now and again, the neutrons that come out will go through the metal and actually start degrading the metal. And one of the single biggest challenges we have, as dumb as it may sound, is actually finding metals that we can use to build the reactor walls that won't be so degraded over time that they literally start falling apart. Mm. That is a problem in metallurgy. It is a simple problem to frame. It is an incredibly difficult problem to figure out, though. And so one of the biggest issues is the reactor vessel metal. And so we haven't yet come up with a really good metal that we can use that will actually be long-term survivable in this kind of scenario. What we actually do to get the energy out is we literally have, I'll call it a blanket, around the reactor that absorbs all of these very fast-moving neutrons and turns that into heat. And so that's, in a sense, how the thing works. It's conceptually fairly straightforward, technically extremely difficult. That's why billions of dollars have been spent over the years, and so far we haven't been able to really come up with something that works. Now, that is a particular type of fusion reactor. It's called the tokamak design, which is just a donut shape for the plasma as it's sort of like creating all of those new atoms and releasing all of the energy. And so there are alternatives. There's something called inertial confinement fusion, where you literally blast a pellet with lasers and compress it together using all of the force from the lasers. That's another thing that's being considered. There are other things that use different types of electrical fields as well. So there are different types of fusion reactor designs, but I'm afraid as yet we've broken even in terms of the amount of energy going in, being able to get that out. But we're still at the point where really we don't have something that's really workable from a commercial perspective. And so the ITER reactor, the International Experimental Reactor, that's supposed to be the first one that really produces a significant amount of energy. And you're looking at this sort of like I think it's late 2020s, early 2030s for that.
Interesting. But if it can be proven to be successful, what's the significance here?
Oh, if we can come up with workable fusion reactors, this is essentially the world's energy problem solved.
Really?
Really, yeah.
Game changer.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, that's why we've been trying to do this for 50 years, 60 yeah. years, in fact. So, but we've never been able to do it because there are all of these technical problems to solve. Like, we've kind of figured out a lot about one of the simplest and most difficult things to fix was actually keeping the plasma stable, because this thing is under so much twisting and torque that it literally wanted to flip out of position. But we think we've actually solved a lot of those control elements. But now it's like the really sort of like challenging hardware issues of like building the actual reactor out of the right metal. Hmm. So it's a challenge.
Brian has a question in regards to energy here this morning. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Yeah, my question is, you talk about reactors and everything, but what about creating a thorium reactor?
Oh.
Thorium's supposed to be much less dangerous than uranium.
Yep.
It's supposed to be a bit more radioactive at first, but its half-life is extremely short, so it drops off really quick. So what do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I actually am a supporter of considering thorium technology, as you just mentioned, the radioactive. Thorium is a fission-type reaction, so things breaking apart. So it does produce some byproducts that are really not good, but they don't have a long half-life and they can be stored pretty well. And so the question that everyone always says once they hear that, oh, rather than uranium, we could use thorium, is why haven't we done this?
And
the short answer is because of nuclear weapons, right? There was a lot of research done on building uranium-based reactors because you could produce plutonium at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Right? And so that has been...
You can't with thorium then.
No, thorium, well, you could probably come up with some kind of reaction chain somewhere along the line, I guess, but I don't know for sure. I'm not sure on that. So, but with thorium, the products that you produce are not dangerous in terms of like nuclear escalation or anything like that. And so the challenge with thorium is you need to have everything in very, very hot salts. Not like table salt. This is a particular chemical name for things. So you need to run the reactor very, very hot, and it's a bit difficult to design because of that. And that's one of the reasons why people haven't really focused on it as well, I think. So, but this is something that some countries that have a significant amount of thorium are taking very seriously. India, for example, has taken this very seriously because they have a lot of thorium deposits. The estimates suggest there's enough thorium in the world to last something like 5,000 or 6,000 years.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So this is something that's become, I don't want to call it fringe. It's far beyond being on the fringe. But what the thing you have to remember, there is a whole industry that makes uranium-based reactors.
Yeah.
Right? And so it's kind of difficult to come along with a new technology and just beat the heck out of that established industry, because there is a lot of development that needs to be done. But there are a number of countries around the world that are looking at thorium. So absolutely, thorium, if we're going to have some kind of fission-based reaction, is the one that I think we should be looking at. But there again, there are arguments on both sides of the fence as well. So, but nonetheless, thorium does look like a really interesting technology.
Answers your question, Brian.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
All right, appreciate the call. Thank you very much. 10:42 is the time right now. Just reading here that Transport Canada wants to study the potential of Hyperloop technology, described as a futuristic mode of high-speed transportation envisioned by eccentric billionaire Elon Musk.
He's eccentric
billionaire. Well, that's what I'm reading,
now,
reading the story here. But, I mean, okay, how realistic is Hyperloop technology, and how significant is Transport Canada's decision to study this?
So the challenge here is that Hyperloop means different things to different people. There are actually a number of quote-unquote Hyperloop projects out there. The first way it was envisaged was as what's called an evacuated tube technology, where you literally just suck all of the air out of the tube. You put something inside it, which in that case would be the transport, and then you fire it along. Because there's no air resistance, it just goes, goes along really, really effortlessly, basically. And so then they realized that evacuating a tube that was really big and really long was actually really hard, right? Because you would need all of these pumps. And so what Musk's original Hyperloop design was something that wasn't completely evacuated. And so it would be partially evacuated, but you would literally increase the pressure behind the actual vehicle itself and then push it along kind of like on a wave of pressure. Right. And so that was the significant advancement in the original Hyperloop Musk design. Since then, I believe there's been a break off of a company that was originally part of his development group. He's still got his own one that's going along as well. And then they're looking at smaller tubes that you can evacuate more easily as well. So there's a bunch of different things. And I have to be honest and say, I don't know which ones Transport Canada would have been particularly looking at. If I'm completely honest, I'm not 100% convinced that people are going to be entirely comfortable with this mode of transport, because you'll be inside a tunnel, right, and going along very quickly.
But here's the benefit here. It says a link between Montreal and Toronto would be about a 45-minute commute if these these pods would travel at about 1,000 kilometers an hour.
Right. So what they're really trying to do to leverage infrastructure is talking about building these sort of like tubes going alongside motorways and things like that to use that.
Though Musk is building an underground tunnel in Los Angeles.
Exactly. So Musk's viewpoint is very much that this is useful in a metro environment where you really can't build these things above ground. But everyone brings up questions of like, oh, well, you know, what terrorists going to do blowing these things up and so on? Because once you sort of like blow things up and the pressure goes, it stops working.
Yeah.
You know, that's true of a road. You can put things on a road and blow a road up. So I don't really put too much stock in that. It's just going to be a question of how expensive they are to put together. I mean, rail is always expensive. Is this going to be cheaper than rail? That's probably going to be the big question. Because when you really get down to it, the difference between 700 miles an hour versus 250 miles an hour is not a huge factor of three. You've got to be going a really long way for that to make a significant difference.
I'm just looking at the estimated cost of this Montreal to Toronto loop. It says here about a $15 billion cost, excluding purchase of the land. So
you got to think that the land is going to be the thing that's even more expensive. So that's $15 billion for the technology alone.
Basically, yeah.
I mean, I would like to know how that compares to a high-speed rail. That would be the interesting thing to look at.
Yeah. Well, maybe that'll be part of Transport Canada's study here. Yeah. They say they're studying the potential of Hyperloop technology.
I mean, it's kind of ironic for me coming from the UK where we have trains going everywhere. And over here, people are like, oh, trains, it's really expensive and there aren't very many of them. And it's like, yeah, I can see that. But
Well, we have fallen. Canada has fallen flat when it comes to trains. In this.
Well, it's a councillor out here as well, a commuter rail in Halifax, you know.
Well, we've been talking about that for ages.
Yeah.
Indeed. Now, I know, make that
you're probably going to be talking about it for ages more as well.
I think that's quite possible. 10:45 is our time with Dr. Robin, Science Files, here on a Monday morning, 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. We'll be back to hear more right after this quick break. 10:49 into the home stretch here on a Monday with Dr. Rob in Science Files. And Frank emails us a question. He wonders, are we getting any closer to superconductivity at room temperature? And are space vehicle electrical systems and circuitry benefited in any way by the temperatures in space that he understands approach absolute zero?
That's interesting. Yeah. A couple of technical questions there. Seriously. So let's back up a little bit and talk about what superconductivity is.
What is it?
So if you remember from high school and doing any kind of circuits in high school, Rick's shaking, nodding at the same time. So there is this property of materials called resistance that when you run an electric current through them, you basically waste energy. And so superconductors, by the name, you can imagine super means they're pretty special, means that they have zero resistance. And so they don't actually leak energy when you put an electrical current through them. And so that's really good, because if you had power lines that were made of this material, then you wouldn't be losing energy to the surrounding area. And so the sort of like extreme version of this would be a light bulb filament, right? So when you actually put electrical charge through a light bulb filament, so much energy is being wasted, it heats up and actually starts emitting light.
Right? Okay. Yeah.
So with a superconductor, everyone is sort of like really interested in these because, yeah, it would be awesome. We wouldn't lose energy and so on. So that would be really, really cool. The irony is particularly overwhelming because I've used the word cool there, that things get or tend to be superconducting when they go down to very, very low temperatures. And the explanation is complicated for why it happens. But you can imagine there are electrons going through the metal. And it turns out the metal also has movements of charge within it. They're called phonons, but it doesn't matter. Essentially, what happens when you have superconducting is kind of the electrons and the phonons kind of pair up and they surf along together. That's kind of the best way to put it. And so everyone has been wondering, can we find a material where that you can have superconductivity at like room temperature so we don't have to cool these things down to ridiculous temperatures? And there's been a ton of research done on this for the last three decades, I would say. And so the question is, what's the best one we have right now? And so actually just before Christmas, there was a big announcement that we've now got a material that appears to be superconducting at minus 23 Celsius, which is pretty close. I mean, that's kind of Arctic temperatures, yep, yep, right? So we're getting closer. The one challenge is, in all of these situations where you have these exotic new materials, how well can you produce them, right? So that is the question. And in this particular case, the particular substance that they have is quite difficult to produce. And so they haven't been able to create samples of it that are much bigger than a head of a pin, basically. Mm. So that's always an issue, but we are making projects and progress. And, you know, I'm quietly optimistic that we will find something within the next few years. Okay, that's that one done. So the other one about...
space vehicle electrical systems.
Yeah, yeah. So in general, the short answer is, funnily enough, things that are in the sun actually do get very hot. Right. So you're constantly, if you're turning, you're going from hot to cold in space. And so the reality is these things have to be designed to have a fairly constant kind of resistance no matter what temperature they're at. So you don't want to have things that are superconducting in space if you can avoid it, because they go from being in one situation, just being very hot and functioning in that way, to the other situation in low temperature. You do in general try and protect them with insulation and so on. But in general, no, we don't worry too much about trying to use superconductivity in space.
He mentions temperatures in space. He understands approach absolute zero. What's the difference between absolute zero and zero?
Absolute zero is zero kelvins, right? So okay. Zero kelvins is minus 273.5,
sure.
Right.
Yeah. And okay, let's go back to the phones. And
Paul, left you speechless with that one. Yeah, well,
good morning, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
Hey, Paul.
Pretty good. I'd like to ask Dr. Thacker about something that I've found in regards to uranium in seawater.
All right.
Okay.
And basically that we would have 4 billion tons of uranium in seawater right now that would fuel us for about 100,000 years. I'm wondering how uranium is dissolved in seawater, or how it floats, perhaps, considering its atomic weight is, of course, a heavy metal, and seawater to me, I think, is made up of two elements that are of low atomic weight.
Right. So the short answer is I'm not entirely sure off the top of my head. I would guess that that's uranium present in some kind of salt form or something like that. And if that's the case, then you wouldn't have to worry too much about how it's distributed. You just basically just filter the overall water volume. But I have to imagine this is really tiny amounts, like, I don't know, parts per billion
it's,
or something like that.
Three parts per million of seawater.
Million?
Yeah.
That's actually pretty high. You sure it's not billion?
It is. It's actually, three specks of, or grains of sand, basically, in a liter of water.
Okay. Mm. Well, so my guess would be it is distributed fairly evenly through the column if it's in a salt form. But I don't honestly know. You've caught me a little bit on the edge. I don't know too much about this. The question would be, how efficient can you extract it? But at the end of the day, as I said, I'm not a huge fan of uranium. I'm generally supportive of fission power, but we do tend to create a number of long-lived products that are somewhat difficult to store. So it's not my favorite way, although I do think it's better than a lot of things like natural gas and coal especially.
Yeah,
right?
Indeed.
So
Ted with an email question. It says, my question is about the planet-killing asteroid that killed or destroyed the dinosaurs. And he's wondering, has NASA kept an eye on the asteroid belt to keep an eye on what may impact us in the next half century or so?
Yeah, but basically there are quite a few telescopes that are involved in surveying the sky looking for these things. And we're pretty confident that we've found things up to about the sort of like 1 kilometer size. We think we've got a pretty good track on most of those. But as I've sort of mentioned in the past, there is a direction that's kind of difficult for us to really sort of establish whether there's anything in that direction. And that's towards the sun.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So we talked about this in the past. So one of the things that we do need is telescopes up in space that are looking or can look at a different part of space, kind of off ahead of us, as it were, on an orbit, so they can look back, and then we could see what there are, what there is in that kind of area. And everyone kind of thinks, well, aren't they just kind of like looping around us, so we'll see anyway?
Yeah.
But the answer is no. They can actually have some really very, very strange peanut orbits and so on that mean that they're very difficult to see. And so we do need to have some kind of telescope up there and off to the side. There was a proposal a few years ago for a NEOSAT, a Canadian space telescope, to do that. Unfortunately, it didn't function properly once it was launched. So nonetheless, there is an idea for something called Sentinel, which would be up there. Again, that's a US base. So we do need to do that. But from the ground and looking out everywhere else, yeah, we've got a whole bunch of a network of telescopes. And then coming in 2022, we have the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, which is going to be a really big 8-meter telescope that will survey the southern sky, essentially the whole of it, every 3 days.
Oh, yeah.
That's going to be it's an amazing thing. And they have a whole team of scientists working on all of the software projects for that and so on. So that's an amazing thing that's coming along in 2022 and really should find a whole bunch of things.
We've got about a minute left here. What's this asteroid belt he's talking about?
Oh, yeah. So that's the area between Mars and Jupiter is what's called the asteroid belt, where we have many, many, many of these sort of like objects. I mean, don't sort of think this is like Star Wars. So in Star Wars, they fly through an asteroid belt and there's But it's not that much material. It really doesn't, or it wouldn't feel particularly different from flying in regular space if you were out there. But nonetheless, in terms of the overall density of these objects, there's a lot more of them in the asteroid belt than there is in other parts of the solar system until you get out to the Kuiper belt. But even there, that's very low density as well.
All right. Frank, by the way, who asked the superconductivity question, says, excellent answer. Always a pleasure to hear his explanations. I hear he's a deadly golfer as well. What's his handicap?
My handicap is 8.
Really?
Yeah. Hmm. So I should be better than that, though. I really should be. So.
Well, 8's not bad. Yeah. 8's a lot better than mine.
Sure.
Indeed. Dr. Rob, again, the hour flies right by whenever you drop by. I appreciate your time here again.
Always
this morning.
A pleasure. A lot of fun. And I have to admit that feedback like that is always lovely to hear.
Excellent. That's it. See you next week, next Monday.
Will do.
Dr. Rob Thacker and Science Files. It is now 2 minutes before 11 o'clock. We're going to break for a news update, and then it's your turn to sound off this morning. We've got an open hour coming up next hour. We call it Manic Monday, and of course, as always, anything goes. And our phone lines await your calls now at 902-405-6000 or 1-877-801-8255. Give me a call, and we'll take your calls after the news, and it is coming up next.